Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This morning, a judge denied bail for 20-year-old James Fields Jr., who's charged with plowing his car into a group of people protesting that right-wing rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, this past weekend, killing one woman. Let's get the latest from the weekend that stunned those there and watching at home. Sandy Houseman is Charlottesville Bureau Chief for WVTF and Radio IQ. Sandy, James Fields is being charged with second-degree murder. The Department of Justice is also pursuing a civil rights investigation. So what happens now there?
Well, I think that, of course, the legal proceedings will happen as they do here locally. He's still in the county jail, and we'll see when a trial date is set. As far as the Justice Department investigation, what we're hearing is that Fields was in the Army for several months, and he was discharged because he had very strong Nazi beliefs, and apparently that was incompatible with service in the U.S. military. And if you study his Facebook page, you see a strong attachment not only to Donald Trump, but to Adolf Hitler. So I think there may be something happening at the federal level, possibly some civil rights charges against him.
Well, the rally was organized by a Charlottesville man, Jason Kessler. It's the Unite the Right rally, and he wanted to unite these right-wing groups, Nazi groups, white supremacist groups, groups that often fight. You spoke to some residents there who were upset at what unfolded, to say the least. Let's listen to a little.
I support everyone saying what they want to say, but when it becomes violent, nobody belongs here, and I don't care what your position is.
Do you blame Jason Kessler for what happened yesterday?
Yeah. I think it's his fault, pretty much.
You also blame Donald Trump. You know, the hat says, make America great again, which everybody already knows that means, from the white supremacist view, it means make America white again.
And Sandy, we know the president had a very unsatisfactory response when he equated all sides in the weekend in his first response to what happened there. So what's happening today? What are people saying?
Well, I think that folks were offended by the president's response, and I think we're still getting over the shock of what's happened to Charlottesville. It's a very pleasant place to live. I would say politically, it's a very moderate place. Most people would probably describe themselves as liberals, certainly not radicals, and demonstrations here are rare, let alone the kind of radical violence that we saw over the weekend.
Well, they may not be rare. Right-wing groups after the week, the violence, said they would be back. But residents seem pushed too far. When Jason Kessler, again the organizer, tried to speak publicly to reporters, he was attacked and chased. Let's listen to a little. You were there. Sandy, is there any sympathy? He was punched. He was tackled by a young woman.
None. I think people are very angry with Jason Kessler, and this has been going on for some months. He is a local blogger and a white supremacist, or a white nationalist. I think that's how he refers to himself. He wants everybody of color to go home, quote unquote. But he found some old tweets from the only African-American member of our city council that were sent some years ago when this man was living in the Deep South and had some very unpleasant interactions with whites and so said some racist things. And Kessler began a campaign to get this fellow, Wes Bellamy, off the city council. Bellamy has said, you know, he was young at that point. He had not had worldly experiences. Having come to Charlottesville, he's met many people that he likes of all colors and no longer believes these things. But Kessler tried to get him off the city council and, you know, was blogging, was going around town petitioning. And so he's been pretty unpopular here for quite some time.
Well, he's saying his rights weren't protected. But others are asking why there wasn't enough police presence after the Friday night Nazi march, where the Nazi salute was given, and wasn't enough protection the next day. What are you hearing there?
Yeah, you know, there was plenty of police presence. We had lots and lots of state officers. Eventually, the National Guard was also sent in. City police, county police were all on duty, university police. So that was not the problem. The question is, what orders were they given? And the complaints we hear from some people who were at the rally on Saturday was that some of the officers appeared to be protecting the white supremacists, and other officers clearly ignored fights between the two factions, the counter-protesters and the white supremacists.
Sandy Houseman, Charlottesville Bureau Chief for WVTF and Radio IQ there in Charlottesville. Sandy, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, for more now in Charlottesville, we're joined by a historian there at the University of Virginia who joins us regularly to look at the history behind the news. Brian Ballow is one of the hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Brian, welcome back.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And you were supposed to give a talk on Saturday on the campus about the history of white supremacist groups in America. That was called off when the governor declared a state of emergency. Tell us about what you saw this weekend.
Well, what I saw was really very unsettling, Jeremy. I was on the grounds of UVA. The university had organized a teach-in, frankly, to try to discourage people from going downtown. That teach-in was called off when the governor declared a state of emergency. So I drove back towards the downtown mall after the protesters on all sides had been dispersed. And what I saw were young men carrying semi-automatic rifles, carrying lots of flags with lots of iconography from fascist movements, Nazism. And they were in small knots occupying the high ground, if you will, of a park that I used to take my kids to daily. And I have to tell you, you know, I'm a pretty old guy. I never, ever thought that I would see scenes like that in our United States.
Well, and why do you think it was happening in Charlottesville in particular? And two of the white nationalists that organized the events, Richard Spencer and Jason Kessler, are both graduates of the University of Virginia.
Well, I think you put your finger on one of the elements. They know Charlottesville. Kessler has organized these kinds of events here in Charlottesville before. Spencer has gone on to become more of a national figure. But you're right. They do have some connections. I think groups like this, and now I'm referring to the alt-right, they look for provocation. So they look for relatively liberal enclaves. Now, if you go outside of the city boundaries of Charlottesville, Albemarle County, Central Virginia, is not a particularly liberal place. But in the city of Charlottesville and within the grounds of the University of Virginia, it certainly does lean liberal. And I think they're looking for the kind of attention that they get when people counter their racist nationalist ideology.
A lot of people have been pointing to the president's response over the weekend, or lack thereof, and saying that this is a history-making event for him. As an historian, what do you think?
I absolutely agree that this will define his administration in part because it kind of brings together lots of strains that people were talking about up till this point, and those strains are kind of a wink-wink, nod-nod at these alt-right groups and even neo-Nazi groups, not to mention members of the president's closest staff who have these kinds of leanings. And I also think it's a defining moment because it was a remarkable opportunity for the president. I talked to my son and said, you know, I think President Trump is going to stand up and do the right thing. And my son said, Dad, you're so naive. You're so idealistic. And my son turned out to be right. Donald Trump did not do the right thing, and he missed a great opportunity to actually help the nation heal and address the deep structural causes of this kind of conflict.
Well, what do you think needs to be done now to heal, not just in Charlottesville, but around the country? This was, you know, really an emotional and offensive thing for all Americans to see.
Well, short term and immediately, and right here in the Commonwealth of Virginia, we need to question whether people can openly carry semi-automatic weapons to a protest that everybody knows is bound to be tense. If we can prevent people from carrying weapons into sporting events where emotions flare, surely there is a rational basis for preventing the open carry of weapons. And also, those openly carried weapons stifle free speech. Longer term, I think the leaders in all institutions, from president on down, but private sector, public sector, voluntary sector, have to state what we had come to assume was the obvious, which is we do not endorse groups that espouse racist, anti-Semitic views, period.
Do you think there are going to be more of these events coming up around the country?
Sadly, I do, Jeremy.
That's Brian Ballow, who is a professor of history at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. He co-hosts the weekly podcast Backstory. Brian, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Andrew Bezovich is professor emeritus of international relations at Boston University's Pardee School of Global Studies. He's also a former Army colonel who served in Vietnam. He often joins us here as a military analyst. But today we want to talk to him about this political moment. His recent essay at tomdispatch.com, we'll post it at hereandnow.org, is titled Slouching Toward Mar-a-Lago. It is more about this particular moment. It's more about how we got here, and it doesn't spare. Both parties, he says, are led by aging hacks. The U.S. has long become a monarchy, and while our emperor tweets, Rome itself fiddles. He says we shouldn't spend so much time worrying about the man in the White House. We should be worrying about the culture, the society, the people who put him there. Trump is not cause, but consequence. And Andrew Bezovich joins us in the studio, provocative as always. Welcome back.
Thank you.
You say cause, not consequence, but look first at Charlottesville. President Trump's critics would say he is cause, that the hate groups that gathered there, giving the Nazi salute without any fear, chortling gleefully on social media after the president spoke and made his first comments and did not condemn them. They noted that. The president said, I love everyone. They took that to mean he loves them, that they were emboldened to even have that rally because of President Trump.
But racism pre-exists the Trump administration. We had horrific episodes, manifestations of hatred when President Obama was in the White House.
Some of them backed and fueled by
then
non-President Donald Trump.
So, I mean, I think there's no question that this president has helped to create an environment which is more conducive, which brings these people out of the woodwork. Helps their cause, but he did not create the problem. And then the burden of the argument that I'm trying to make in that essay that you cited is that I think we err when we obsess about the president.
President Trump.
About President Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Because in doing that, we lose sight of the factors that created the conditions that allowed him to become president in the first place. I mean, I would endorse all of the criticisms that have been made – that are made of President Trump on a daily basis, that he's a dissembler, that he's a narcissist, that he's uneducated, that he's uninterested in becoming educated, that he's temperamental, that he lacks judgment. And it's a travesty that he has become the president of the United States. But one gets a sense, as I try to monitor the debate, one gets a sense that the people who oppose Trump think that if we could just goad Trump into resigning tomorrow, that you know by the day after tomorrow everything would be hunky dory. And I think that's not the case.
Well, because you make the case that while those in the anti-Trump resistance, as you call it, have made the resistance the big story. The big story is actually, if I got this right, that for a couple decades now, we have made the president of the United States an outsized character that previously, except for one or two, FDR comes to mind, we just didn't do.
That's part of the argument I'm making. And therefore, when we end up with a character like Donald Trump, we are all appalled.
Well, we aren't all appalled.
Well,
yeah,
fair enough.
Yeah,
right. Fair enough.
Because
I mean,
some see him
tens
as,
of millions of people were not
right.
appalled.
No, but I think that's part of your point, that there is a part of the electorate that is saying, well, what's wrong with that? Because Bill Clinton was a huge outsized character who played saxophone and there was sort of this shimmer of celebrity around him, too.
But the people who voted for him, in my judgment, voted for him, I want to say this carefully, for what they considered to be good reasons. That is to say, as Trump supporters viewed the direction of the country, I think particularly since the end of the Cold War, assess the ideas, the principles that seem to be guiding the direction of the country, they said, "Hey, these aren't working for me." And his genius, if you want to call it that, was being able by 2016 to be able to tap that collective animosity and to bring these people into the voting booth to cast votes for him. But and my point here is that what deserves more attention than I believe it's getting is what the heck are those ideas? Mm-hmm. What course did we follow? We the country, in the wake of the Cold War, this moment of great victory, this moment when, in a famous article, Francis Fukuyama said we had reached the end of history, when all the basic problems of humankind had supposedly been resolved. What happened after that? And I think what happened after that is the country went deeply wrong, and in some senses, the election of Donald Trump is a reflection of a growing awareness that the country had gone wrong. So that's not, and that's not an endorsement of Donald Trump. Really, it's simply an appeal to say, let the conditions that created him deserve far more attention than they have been getting.
And they are what? I mean, you say it's the ideas.
All right.
Stupid.
So
and
what's, are the ideas?
Yeah.
I mean, my hypothesis is that idea number one is that globalization was going to bring us to some kind of a collective utopia, that globalization, in given its capacity, globalization really shorthand for corporate capitalism, American-style corporate capitalism on a planetary scale, that was going to create so much wealth that it was going to be a problem solver. Well, it turned out that it did create great wealth and left a whole lot of people behind and hurting and disenchanted. So globalization didn't live up to its promises. Second idea, I think, was the notion that the United States was going to continue to be the great leader of the world and that the availability of superior American military power was the instrument whereby we would maintain peace, harmony, and our preeminence. And that has led us, in my judgment, to a series of pretty stupid wars, unsuccessful wars, costly wars, with no end in sight.
Of course,
Trump promised that there would be an end, but of course, now that he's president, there's still no end.
Well, and I have to note, for those who may not have heard you on our program before, that you know you lost a son in one of those wars, and so this is something that you have followed very closely. But the third is this idea of muscular global leadership by the U.S.
That's what I was referring to.
Yeah,
I mean, because it takes a military form. The third idea, and this is the one that, candidly, I have the hardest time articulating, is the conception of individual freedom that we collectively have embraced. And I'll say it in blunt terms that many people will disagree with, but it seems to me that increasingly, and I think the end of the Cold War is sort of a rough date for when this tendency matures, and that is that we've abandoned sort of the traditional Judeo-Christian rooted notions of how we are to behave, and we collectively, many of us, have embraced the notion that there should be no limits on the exercise of personal freedom.
Give me an example.
Well, I think that the example is particularly evident in the whole realm of sexuality and gender relations. And I don't want to sound like I'm sort of somehow against all this. What I do argue is that the expectations of those who have promoted this broader conception of freedom have not yielded happiness, solidarity, a collective sense of being engaged as people, as Americans, in some kind of an enterprise that we are all committed to. I mean, when I look at our country, opioid addictions, epidemics of obesity, epidemics of porn. These are not indications of a healthy society. Yeah. So we have more freedom today as individuals than we ever have had, but something ain't right.
Well, look, you have a 10-point plan to fix it. We have 90 seconds. So, you know, you have a lot of, in your prescription, abolish the Electoral College, roll back gerrymandering, limit the impact of corporate money on elections, mandate a balanced federal budget. We'll post everything at tiernow.org.
That's not my argument for how to fix it.
Exactly.
It's my argument for let's clear away some of the debris that has accumulated since the end of the Cold War that gets in the way. I don't have a recipe for how to fix it. I believe that I see myself as a conservative. I think principled conservatives have things to say in this with regard to this issue. I strongly believe that principled progressives have things to say, and we need to have a debate. You know, the core question of the debate is, what is the definition of the common good in America in the 21st century? We need an answer to that question.
You know what? I'm going to throw that out to listeners. What makes an American? As you say, for a long time, an American was someone who fought the Soviets. That's what defined Americans in the Cold War. With that gone, what is an American? Hereandnow.org. Andrew Bacevich, Professor Emeritus of International Relations at BU. Thank you so much. We'll post your article at tomdispatch.com. We've barely scratched the surface, but it's a good scratch. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Here and Now.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
President Trump's infrastructure plan calls for a lot of private investment. Instead of taxpayers footing the whole bill for infrastructure projects, he would rely on public-private partnerships. But in Indiana, one of those private projects building the final stretch of I-69 just had to be taken over by the state after falling way behind schedule. Caitlin Lang is State House reporter for the Indianapolis Star. Caitlin, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And what's going on with the highway project at this point in Indiana?
Yeah, so the I-69 highway project is 2 years behind schedule. It was supposed to be completed in 2016. At the time, then-Governor Mike Pence chose to do a public-private partnership to complete the construction so that the cost would be placed on the private sector and the risk as well. But the company they chose ended up having some financial troubles, and now the state is taking the project back over. So it's no longer a P3, as they call it. So just been a lot of struggles down there for the people in Bloomington as they've had to deal with the delays in the construction.
What's the cost to taxpayers from having the state take it back?
So the state says there won't be additional cost. Under the agreement, the company that won the construction bid was also supposed to handle maintenance for the next 35 years. Now that the state is taking over the project, it's difficult to predict how much that maintenance will be. We really won't know for the next, you know, three decades. But critics are also saying a lot of the cost was in the delay of construction with, you know, increased accidents, less business to the area, so more of an inconvenience cost on that end.
Are people in Indiana looking at this as a failure of the whole idea of public-private partnerships or as kind of a one-off failure?
Most people are looking at it as just one example of a failure. The big thing that critics are saying is that the state just didn't vet this company properly. There were some red flags they missed, like they bid an extremely low amount, and there were just some flaws with the company, like they didn't have any experience in the states on road projects. So the main thing people are saying is that this was just an issue with vetting the company. Obviously, you're going to have critics of P3s who are writing off the whole idea, but most people here in the state are still, you know, looking to do this for other projects in the future.
What is Vice President Pence saying about this, if anything?
So he didn't really say much about it, but he has been still talking up P3s at a national level. During Infrastructure Week, he talked to a bunch of mayors and governors, emphasizing this need for private partnerships like this, but he hasn't really directly talked about the I-69 project.
He wasn't all that popular when he left the governorship in Indiana, was he?
No, not that popular. He was actually going through a governor's race, and it was supposed to be a close one, so... Some people saw it as kind of a good thing for him to be moving on to the vice president-elect at the time, just because he wouldn't have to worry about the state race. You had the RFRA scandal in our state, and that definitely left a blemish on his record here.
And when you say RFRA, by the way, you're talking about the Religious Freedom Restoration Act that people may remember Mike Pence was involved in. He had to back off that, right?
Right. That was a huge public image issue for him at the time.
That's Caitlin Lang, who is State House Bureau reporter for the Indianapolis Star. Caitlin, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Across 45 states, some 400 school districts have pushed the start time for teenagers back after 8 a.m. There's the Davis Joint Unified School District in California, Sturgis Public Schools in Michigan, Jessamine County Schools in Kentucky. Nevada, Rhode Island, Maine, and other states are considering statewide mandates with similar legislation. But now the biggest state of all, California, is weighing in. Legislators there are considering a bill that would require all middle and high schools to open 8:30 or later. Well, it's ignited quite a debate, and let's have it now. First, State Senator Anthony Portantino, a Democrat representing the San Fernando, San Gabriel Valleys. He proposed the bill. He joins us in the studio to talk about it. Happens to be in town. Senator, you want to move it back to 8:30. Why?
Well, there's been 20 years of research that was crystallized in an American Academy of Pediatrics study that was published in 2014 that says high school and middle school, teenage school start time should be no earlier than 8:30 for basically two reasons. Teenage biology and development prevents them from falling asleep before 11 or 10:45 on average. Mm-hmm. So this idea that parents should just put their kids to bed earlier is contrary to actual biology of the teens. They're physically incapable of falling asleep before 11.
Most people who have tried it understand that.
Right. Yeah. And also in concert with that is teenagers should get about 10 hours of sleep at night, and they get 4.5 to 5 hours of sleep a night. The other piece of the science is the morning deep sleep that teens do get is the most therapeutic and most healthy time for them to be rejuvenated and heal and be healthy. The 400 school districts around the country that have moved to a late start have seen remarkable results. Test scores have gone up, GPA gone up, graduation rates gone up, and attendance has gone up. At the same time, depression goes down, obesity goes down, drug use goes down.
Really? Just from moving the school start time from 8 to 8:30? You also say that, you know, there's proof that there's fewer car accidents because kids aren't as tired.
Absolutely. A number one killer of teens in America, car accidents. Car accidents significantly go down with that extra hour of sleep in the morning. Number two killer of teens is suicide. The number of depressed and suicide thoughts goes down. So that's why it's important to look at this as a statewide issue, because it's a public health issue.
But you know the argument that it may be practically impossible in many homes, because unlike years ago when we actually did start school later, we have two working parents or single working parents in most homes, and they can't be there to get that child to school they have to go to work.
Here's what's exciting about that. Children of working parents are the most sleep deprived. Those kids see the greatest benefit from that extra hour of sleep. The bill has a 2-year implementation cycle, so communities can come together to work with their working parents, work with the logistics of each community to put this in place.
But what if it's the parent that has to get the kid to school and they have to drive them at a certain time, which is earlier, in order for them to get to work on time?
Communities come together to adjust, but what happens is the working parents who have to struggle to get there come back afterwards and say, my goodness, I haven't had this great a relationship with my kids. They're performing better. And that's what the research conclusions draw. They say, yes, there are adult-based logistical issues, but the overriding significant positive benefit to the teens is worth that inconvenience.
Do you worry about the extra costs that might be incurred, bus routes that might have to be implemented?
Right now, there's an extra hour of after-school time that schools have to budget to accommodate. they shift those resources to the morning. School districts will flip their bus schedule. They'll take the big kids first and then use the buses for the little kids. Those who will argue against this will say there's increased costs, but the evidence doesn't show that. Those who argue against this will say somehow it's going to affect sports schedules. Well, the reason why it's a mandate is so all of the after-school schedules are coordinated.
Well, but the argument is don't do it statewide. Don't make it one size fits all because not every district is the same.
And that's district why we're agnostic on what's called zero period. For the districts that have those voluntary programs before first period, we're not touching what happens before first period.
Are you saying a district would be able to have a period before 8:30 where kids could be brought in to do something if their parents have to go to work?
Many school districts have a zero period, which is before first period. This bill is completely and totally agnostic on zero period. Now, what's great about it is, let's say your school district starts at 7:30, first period. Your zero period is at 6:30 now. So again, that slides back later too. So even those kids in zero period are seeing the benefit from the later start. So the arguments against it are logistical, parent-adult-based arguments. How many times have you heard a politician, how many times have you heard a community leader say, we should think about our kids and we should put the best interests of our healthy kids first? That's what this does.
California State Senator Anthony Portantino, his bill that will require California middle and high schools to start no earlier than 8:30 in the morning first period, will go for a final vote next month. Senator, thank you.
You got it. Thank you very much.
Well, now, for the other side of the debate, let's bring in Nancy Chavez Espinoza, a legislative advocate with the California School Boards Association, or CSBA. They oppose Senator Portantino's later school start legislation. Nancy, why?
CSBA recognizes the importance of students getting enough sleep. Of course we do. Many of us are parents. We don't oppose later start times. We oppose this bill because it imposes a one-size-fits-all approach that we don't actually think will result in kids getting more sleep. The reason for that is that most working parents don't have the choice to start work later. Already, there's too little funding for school buses and for before-school programs, so kids will be dropped off at the same time they're already dropped off at school.
Well, and the senator made the point that there is this zero class that starts before homeroom or the beginning of the day, and that that would be moved back a little bit. So in other words, if it was 6:30, it would be 7:30 in this case. But you're saying what? That parents, because of their work schedules, would have to drop the kids off even earlier?
Two things. The zero period actually complicates things. It effectively creates two different start times for the regular school day. It creates more difficulties in terms of staffing and transportation. So working parents who don't have the flexibility to start work an hour or more later are effectively left with two choices. They can drop off their kids at the time they're dropping them off now, regardless of whether or not there's anyone at school to supervise them and make sure they're safe, or they can leave their kids as young as 11 years old, responsible to get themselves to school. And you have to remember, we have school choice here in California, so not everybody attends a neighborhood school within walking distance.
But what do you say about all the science, all the studies? The University of Minnesota found students who sleep 8 or more hours less likely to have depression or fall asleep in class. Both the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Medical Association say middle and high schools should start no earlier than 8:30. What do you say to that?
We definitely want our kids to arrive on campus rested and ready to learn. There seems to be a mistaken impression out there that school boards are not qualified to weigh the scientific evidence and to make the appropriate decision. But in fact, school boards routinely weigh this type of evidence when we're deciding what kinds of programs and interventions to set up for our students. And it's important to note that the studies that have been presented to our legislators here in California omit some pretty important points. For example, they don't talk about the effect that exposure to the blue light from cell phones and tablets is having on circadian rhythms of teens.
And nobody doubts that there is an issue of cell phones and kids and staying up late at night. But as you know, a clinical professor at the Stanford Center for Sleep Sciences and Medicine, Rafael Paleo, wrote a letter to your organization saying that you've misrepresented the study that was published in the journal Nature in 2017. There is simply no controversy, Dr. Paleo writes. Adolescents in the U.S. are sleep deprived. It's affecting their health. And he urges your group to reconsider your opposition to this bill. Isn't there a chance that something can be done to address what is a serious concern of yours, that parents are the ones who have to get these kids to school, and more parents and in particular single parents, are working and working earlier hours. Isn't there something school districts can do to take care of those kids?
So first off, I haven't seen that letter, Robin, but it's important to separate the phenomenon, the symptom of sleep deprivation, from the one-size-fits-all solution that this bill would impose. Many school districts that have explored this issue and considered adopting later start times determined that the better solution for them was to re-examine the homework load so that they could make sure that kids wouldn't be staying up late doing their homework, for example. That's why school times should be a local decision informed by parents and teachers, those who know the students and the community best. And unfortunately, this bill would negate the entire public decision-making process. And we just don't think that's the best way to do right by kids.
Yeah. That's Nancy Chavez Espinoza, legislative advocate for California School Boards Association, the CSBA. They oppose the bill in California, which would require middle and high schools to start at 8:30 or later. Nancy, thank you. We'll follow this.
Thank you, Robin.
So, has your school district gone to later start times for teens? Is your state considering it, as California is? We'd love your thoughts at hereandnow.org.
Merck CEO Kenneth Frazier announced today he was stepping down from the American Manufacturing Council because of President Trump's response to Charlottesville. President Trump responded to the news today on Twitter, saying now that Ken Frazier of Merck Pharma has resigned from President's Manufacturing Council, he will have more time to lower rip-off drug prices. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from New York, as he does each Monday. Hi, Derek.
Hi, Jeremy.
And Frazier, for people who don't know, is one of the few African-American CEOs of a major company in this country. His resignation comes as the country is trying to make sense of what happened in Charlottesville. But what do you make of this and President Trump's response?
I want to give this the proper context. Over the weekend, a group of white supremacists and neo-Nazis marched in Charlottesville to protect a statue of Robert E. Lee, the general of an army that fought to preserve the legal enslavement of black people in America. Trump did not directly criticize the white supremacists over the weekend, but he did directly criticize a black CEO for leaving his manufacturing council in the aftermath of those deadly events. So this to me is doubly shocking. First, critiquing Nazis reflexively is sort of a low bar to set for public officials, and Trump managed to find his way under it over the weekend. A defender could say, well, look, the president doesn't like to directly attack groups or individuals. He prefers to be vague as a general rule. But of course, that's hogwash. And we were reminded of its hogwashery just this morning when he attacked a black CEO by name just a day after declining to attack white supremacy by name. And so the events of this weekend were shocking enough, but it's the juxtaposition of those events with his instinctive tweet against Kenneth Frazier that I think gives you the full measure of the scandal of this moment.
That he's willing to step out there and specifically condemn somebody, and it makes it all the more noticeable that he didn't the other day.
That's exactly right. Yes, he declined to specifically criticize the white supremacists, and then he instinctively directly criticized the black CEO who offended him. I mean, the universal theory of Trump here, I guess, is that if you give him flattery, you get flattery, and if you criticize, you get more criticism. And there is a kind of logic to this, I guess, in a sort of Old Testament sort of way. But it is divorced from any sense of morality. It is divorced from any sense of who deserves flattery, who deserves criticism. It does not come easily to this president to critique people who offer him praise or support, even when they are enemies of the country, like Vladimir Putin, or even when they stand against the very history of the United States, like white supremacists and neo-Nazis. And so I think that it is precisely this that sort of plagues the president and his instincts and his mind to so easily associate himself with anybody who offers him flattery, even when they represent the opposite of this country's values.
Is it likely that other members of the Manufacturing Council will now leave as well because of this?
That's such a good question, and it's something that I was thinking about. You know, I have not talked to any of those CEOs this morning. I have not talked to anybody who represents their views. But I have to think that these are CEOs who understand that their participation in the Manufacturing Council is not just a signal of their support for the future of American manufacturing. It's also a signal of support, of tacit support at least, for this president's efforts. You saw just this morning, let's assume that they too are not making moral decisions. decisions, but rather financial or calculated decisions. The stock for Merck actually went up after Fraser left the council. So even if they are merely thinking about their fiduciary duties, they might perceive this president to be such a toxic alliance that they have to leave his council as Fraser did and as Elon Musk has done as well.
Derek, what about the images that we saw over the weekend of people marching in the streets of an American city with Nazi flags, armed in many cases? It was a scary moment for people to notice that this kind of thing is still around in the United States. What did you think?
It made me scared. I felt fear and shame and horror. But I also think that sort of visceral emotional reaction needs to be put in another context. And that context is the country at large, in which neo-Nazism is not a major movement. White supremacy, I see no evidence that it is a major movement in terms of the number of people associated with it. It certainly has an outsized presence in the media. But there is a lot of happier news when you sort of canvass the country in a larger respect. Attitudes toward immigration now are actually much more liberal than they were just 16 months ago, 2 years ago, much more open toward immigration, people who have different backgrounds who weren't necessarily born here. Public support for the president declines when he does things like this, which suggests that even now at the margins, these are not popular decisions. And this president's attitude toward these groups is not well supported. Even the protests, the protests against white supremacy that you saw across the country this weekend, if you add them all up, were potentially bigger than the white supremacy protests. So I think it's important to, yes, honor the horror of this moment, but also reflect more generally that this is a tiny minority and the majority can still win.
That's Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, thanks so much as always.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.